This is the Medicast, August 29th, 2011.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters.
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of the Medicast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Podmedic, and I'd like to welcome everybody to the program this week. We have a lot of good stuff coming up for you here, including part two of our section on capnography. I had a great opportunity to pull in Troy Smith, who is a paramedic and educator in Washington State. Gotten to know Troy through Physio-Control and our mutual association with that organization and company, and he's one of their premier educators on this topic. So I'm really excited that Troy reached out and said, hey, let's do something on capnography, and hopefully I'm going to catch up with him here in just a couple of days at EMS World Expo in Las Vegas, and we're going to talk a lot more in-depth about capnography. In the meantime, I do want to remind you to check out all the links and the resources available here at the Medicast. You'll find all of that over at medicast.com/blog. There's a link for the show notes right at the top of the page, and you can scroll down and find all the episodes listed there. The most recent episode will be listed first, and you can find all of them, all the way back to episode one. We're getting close to 300 shows here on the Medicast, and that's really exciting. I'm looking forward to really just keeping the move forward, and bringing out this show on a weekly basis is challenging sometimes, but it is encouraging when I hear from all of you. So I'd love it when you check out the show over at the website. I love it when you leave comments over there. And of course, I also especially love it when you reach me by email as well. So send those emails in to podmedic@mac.com. You can reach me there and I will get back to each and every one of you. I love to hear from you with suggestions, comments, corrections, whatever you have. And also love to hear from you in other ways as well. You can reach me on the voicemail line, 941-306-3342, 941-30-MEDIC. You can also catch up with me on Twitter and Facebook under the handle PodMedic. So catch me on Twitter.com/PodMedic or Facebook.com/PodMedic. And of course, the Medicast fan page, Facebook.com/MedicCast. Let's jump on into some listener mail and contacts here coming right up. Let's jump on into this week's listener mail segment, and got a couple of things. Got an email in from Avi. I got to check his email here. Let me just pull that up and look, make sure I get this correct. Avi Goldstein, and he's a paramedic in New York City, also the founder of the company StatGear. He came up with a great idea to give us a good way to keep that piece of tape, you know, that roll of tape we try to keep on our stethoscope so we always have it handy and it falls off and it goes everywhere. He created a great tool to keep that in place and make it easy to pull tape off of it and everything else. It's a kind of a stethoscope tape dispenser. And he sent me an email just kind of showing me that and touching base with me about catching up with me at EMS World Expo this week, and I'm looking forward to that. You know, one of the things we try to do here is feature innovative products that come out. If you're a paramedic or EMT especially, and you've developed a new product, a new tool, or you know of somebody who has, get in touch with me. You know, we charge the big companies big bucks to talk about their products. But if you're a little guy and you're getting started out and you're just trying to show that you got a good idea, I'll take a look at anything. He sent me an email and had a YouTube link video that he showed me. You can see it for yourself at statgeartools.com. I also posted the video over on the Medicast fan page on Facebook at facebook.com/medicast. So you can find them both places. Really a neat tool. And so I would just point out to you that, you know, this is a community effort here. And if you're a part of the Medicast community and you have a good idea for something and you'd like to share it, you know, with me and see if I think it's, you know, worth sharing with the rest of the community, or if I have some ideas on how you can get the information out better, you know, I'm here to help out too. And we can support each other. I know Keith over at Bariatrics has a great tool, and he's helping us out and sponsoring an episode over in the podcast studio, and I'm really excited about that. He's got that excellent abdominal restraint tool for bariatric patients that just makes it easier to keep those top-heavy patients in center of gravity and center of mass, so when you're moving them on a stretcher. And, you know, Keith came up with a great idea, and we were happy to feature his product last year at EMS, Today, I guess it was. And so we want to do the same thing for you, is help you find, you know, a way to have a great idea. And if you're looking for something, good gifts or tools for you to use, we try to do that too. So thanks a lot, Avi. I'm looking forward to catching up with you at EMS World Expo. And for those of you out there, you should check out statgeartools.com and check out what he's got for keeping the tape in place on your stethoscope. We also caught up with a couple of folks over on Facebook. Listener Bennett has been a longtime listener and supporter here of the Medicast and really the whole EMS community as far as podcasters and EMS 2.0. And Bennett started his own blog and is getting ready to release that officially. And when he does, we'll feature it here on the show. You know, if you're interested in starting a blog, if you're interested in getting more involved in social media, if you're interested in starting a podcast, you know, reach out to me, reach out to Chris Montero or some of the other folks online. I don't know of an EMS member of the social media community, blogger, podcaster, tweet expert, whatever, that wouldn't be happy to help teach you the ropes and get you started so that we can have a richer community here. It's one of the most amazing things is just the number of people that I've become friends with, that I've met just through doing this show. And, you know, I think of each and every one of you out there as a potential friend here and as certainly a valuable member of this community. And I look forward to opportunities to meet you and reach out to you and help you make the EMS community a better place. And certainly, you know, Bennett's just an excellent example of that. So, Bennett, thanks for reaching out to me and catching up with us about what you're doing with your new blog. And as soon as you're ready to make that go to prime time, you let me know. And we'll feature it here on the show, talk about it, and we'll also get something posted on the Facebook page and other places because, again, it's all about supporting the entire community so that we can make EMS 2.0, we can make the social media aspects of what we do a much richer and much more supportive environment for making us all better EMS professionals. And I hope you'll take advantage of that. So Bennett caught up with me on Facebook. Avi sent something in to me via email. Whatever the case may be, you know, it's always great to hear from you. And I would urge you to continue to reach out to me either on Facebook under the handle PodMedic, Twitter under PodMedic, or you can catch me PodMedic@Mac.com via email. And again, however you do it, catch up with me. Let me know what you're doing. And if you're going to be at the EMS World Expo coming up, make sure you come by and say hi. Let's jump on into our news segment. And first off, I'd like to kick off with a story that, actually one of several stories that's come to my attention recently about EMS professionals and alcohol while they're driving or before they're driving or associated with their driving. You know, call it DUI, call it DWI, whatever you want to call it. It's an alarming trend of articles. And I'm not going to say it's a trend in general, but certainly a lot of articles recently either brought to my attention through my own searches for news items related to EMS or through listeners like Randy and others who sent me several articles related to different incidents associated with EMS professionals who have been engaged in allegedly driving under the influence. I've got one article listed here in the show notes, but there's just tons of them out there. And it's very alarming to me when I see this happen in situations with people that should know better. And I'm not just talking about adults who should know better, but people who see firsthand the aftermath associated with driving under the influence and what kind of dangers it causes and what kind of problems it causes to their family members, to the families of people that might be injured. It boggles my mind. And I know that people have problems. I know that there are issues out there. You know, earlier in the summer, we had a whole focus on that EMS culture of safety. One of the things that's part of that EMS culture of safety is changing the way we deal with the risk management for ourselves. How are we managing risks? Are we doing things that we know aren't right, but do them anyway because we don't think it's going to happen to us? And that goes with managing how we eat, managing how we drink, managing how we drive. And of course, drinking alcohol and driving together are just a problem in general, but it could be speeding. It could be wearing seatbelts. Culture of safety, changing the way we think about safety, should be second nature to us. And yet, again and again and again and again, I find that EMS professionals, in some cases, are risk takers and inappropriately risk takers. We should be taking risks when we have a reason to do so, and we have also balanced the risk versus the benefits that can be associated with taking that risk. So, you know, this article showed up and associated with, you know, all the emails and contacts and links that I got related to different incidents around the country recently associated with inappropriate DUIs. And, you know, it's just wrong, folks. And I can't imagine that this is something that EMS professionals should be associated with, let alone the fact that every time somebody gets named in the news as an EMT or a paramedic caught for a DUI, the reason they tell them what their profession is because they want to point out that they should have known better. And it just makes us all look bad in the eyes of the public. Next up in the news is a look at what to do to help get us looking better in the public eye. You know, last week and in the past weeks, I've talked about what we need to do to educate our patients about how they understand what we do and what to expect from us and what we can and can't do for them. Last week's episode in the news, remember that episode where we talked about the CAT dispatch, the people in the UK called 999 to have an ambulance dispatched for their five-year-old. Unfortunately, when the paramedics got there, it was their five-year-old cat. This is where we need to educate our public that we are not a cat ambulance. So we need to make sure that people understand what it is that they need to do. I think that this is a great example in this next article here in the news about how to do that. Staff writer Ben Klein at the Peabody, Kansas Gazette Bulletin got an opportunity to sit down with a paramedic in local service and talk to that paramedic about what they can and can't do and how they serve their public, how they make decisions about where to go and transport patients, how they are all about helping patients, and that it's the patient's health that is the priority for the paramedic. This is a great article. You want to know what kind of article you need to have out there talking about your service and educating the public about what you do? This is a perfect example of how to go about doing that. And it really helps educate people on how to interact with you appropriately. They need to know what the rules are, that we need to take them to the closest hospital in many situations. We can't let them pick and choose which hospital to go to. That can be different from protocol to protocol and system to system, but ultimately you need to know where your hospital, what hospital you're going to be transported to. You know, a lot of patients call 911 and then get very upset when they find out that, well, no, we're not taking you to this specialty hospital because your symptoms don't call for it. We're going to take you to the local community hospital. And I've had patients refuse service and then get in and drive themselves to the other hospital, which is probably what they should have done to begin with. It is something that we need to educate people on what to expect. And we may be able to cut down on 911 calls or 999 calls or whatever your system uses to help them to understand what to get, and so they're not going to call us as frequently for things that we can't serve them for. They also, on the other side of that, we may get someone to call us who might not otherwise have called us when they needed to. So there's two sides of this story, not just eliminating needless calls for 911 services, but also encouraging people to call when it's appropriate and to let them know the type of caring medical professional they're going to get on that ambulance when they walk through the door. And I think that this is a perfect example of how to build that expectation. Of course, you know, as we get into our final news item today, one of the challenges with having that expectation is that if you don't get that kind of careful, caring EMS professional who walked through the door, you're going to have a very upset member of the public with you. And you know, again, we're going to go into a situation here where we've got a bad thing that happened with EMS professionals. An individual died, allegedly as a result of inappropriate, or at least contributing to the death, was an inappropriate EMS care on the scene. As you know, and as I've been saying for the last 6 years here on the MedicCast, I don't like to second-guess medics in the field. So I'm not going to say whether they did the right thing or the wrong thing, because I don't have the data here to do that. It's a tragic situation when anyone dies. But for whatever reason, responders to a call, initial responders to a 911 call for a patient with respiratory distress, had arrived to take care of this individual. And this is an interview in this article with the fiance of the person who died. And she's very upset, of course, as you would expect. They arrived on the scene. For whatever reason, the transport unit didn't arrive for nearly 30 minutes. So an ambulance arrived to take this patient to the hospital, but the first responders had arrived initially and for whatever reason did not stabilize the patient appropriately, or according to investigations from the state, may not have stabilized this patient appropriately. And then, went on to take the patient to the hospital, where there seemed to have been allegedly some other balls dropped in the patient care process along the way. So what are we talking about here? Well, you know, one of the things that they say is that they came to the door without anything in their hands, and they started to talk to the patient without ever really initiating care of the patient. So this is like one of my pet peeves, right? There's two sides to this. There are some people, EMTs and paramedics, that walk into the room, they don't say a word to anybody, and they start doing stuff to the patient. That's bad. On the other side of things, there are some people who are way too lackadaisical about what the patient sees as a medical emergency. Now, clearly this was a medical emergency. This guy died. But when patients call us, it's their emergency, not ours. We may not see a nosebleed as a major medical emergency, but they do. And we certainly need to treat every call with a certain sense of urgency. I'm not saying we run around like chickens with our heads cut off, but we should be approaching every call with a sense of urgency, prepared to treat a potential emergency as it occurs. If somebody's calling in with a nosebleed and they're very concerned, and it's because they've got a lot of blood and they think they're going to bleed out through their left nostril, well, we should at least go in prepared to stop bleeding. We should have our gloves on, we should have some gauze pads ready, and we should be prepared to immediately assess and take care of the immediate problem for that patient. You know, we train all the time about treating life threats and dealing with life threats on patients. Sometimes we need to deal with the patient's perceived life threats and be attentive to the anxiety of the patient and the family members that are present. So the lesson to be learned from this particular situation is, don't show up at the door empty-handed. Bring whatever equipment and materials you have with you. Be proactive in your assessment of the patient. Move quickly towards at least taking some resolution towards applying some form of treatment to the patient. Oxygen, opening, you know, helping them to maintain an open airway if they're anxious about not being able to breathe. Whatever you can do with the tools you have readily at hand, but taking those steps quickly, and even if it's not a true emergency on your, after you assess the patient, at least acknowledge in some way through your actions and through your words that you acknowledge that this seems serious to the patient, that they called you because they were really thinking there was a problem, and acknowledge that. Not making them feel like idiots for calling you, not making them feel foolish for calling you, because guess what? The next time they don't call you and it is an emergency. So you have to really balance how you deal with this. And again, being a caregiver, you know, the key part of that word is not give. The key part of that word is care. And so you need to be caring in your approach to taking care of these patients. And I hope that you will acknowledge at least that there's some things you can do for every single patient out there to make them feel a little bit better. Even your frequent flyers, even those patients that you just wish would stop calling for services that they really don't need. You know, there are often underlying things going on in somebody's life. And if you can identify what that problem is, you may be able to deal with a long-term issue by through a relatively simple solution. And that comes from, first off, caring about every single patient. So, again, check out the links in the show notes for these news articles. And if you have any comments or suggestions or questions about them, you know, send them in to me, leave a comment over on the website, or you can, of course, reach me via email, podmedic@mac.com. And let's start a discussion about what you think of these particular news items that deal very explicitly with how people perceive EMS professionals in their communities. Time now for this week's tip of the week, and we're going to pick up with part two of our segment on capnography and care of our patients with this tool, and are we utilizing this tool most completely. Got Troy Smith coming in again to pick up where he left off last week, and really this discussion really focuses this week on what it means for you, the EMS professional. What do you need to do to be a better caregiver and provider for your patients using a tool like capnography, and why is it important for you to use it? So without too much further ado, let's jump into the continuing discussion we recorded recently with Troy Smith from Washington State. He's a paramedic and educator there, and sharing with us his passion and knowledge on capnography. What's one of the first things they do when we get into the ER with a patient that we're monitoring? You know, capnography. They take that off.
They laugh about what this little thing is, and they yard it off.
That's right. You know, and it's the device that we've been using to monitor this patient's perfusion, their return of spontaneous circulation following an arrest. We're using that tool, and the first thing they do when they get to the hospital is pull it off. That's starting to change. And I'm intrigued by you saying that the PCA pumps are starting to have this device integrated, because it's the perfect application of this device in the hospital setting. And, you know, I love the story about the anesthesiologist. That must be like, they must have go to school and learn that, because that is one of the first things they did for me too. And after being, you know, after having it drummed into me through my EMTB training and all through everything, you know, airway, oxygen, and he just sat there and said, "Now watch the clock."
Yep, it is. And, you know, I always kind of laugh a little bit, because none of our patients are hyperoxygenated for the time that they get when they're doing elective surgeries. And, you know, they're, for the most part, healthy patients. So all these patients started at 98, 99% or 100%. You know, ours typically aren't there when we're starting. So we're, well, yes, their oxygen saturation can maintain for a while. If you're starting at 90% or 85%, there really is a time crunch coming into play there. But, what that illustrates is it illustrates the difference between measuring pulse oximetry to monitor ventilatory status and using capnography to monitor ventilatory status. Yeah. Capnography will give you a much quicker and more accurate objective tool to measure that ventilatory status than pulse oximetry.
Yeah, it's about the limitation of the tool.
Pulse oximetry, let me be clear.
Right. It's a limitation in the tool that measures pulse oximetry and what actually pulse oximetry measures versus something that's much more definitive about what's going on at the cellular level, like end-tidal CO2.
When we talk about end-tidal CO2 and measuring ventilatory status, that is one of the things that we can, you know, early on, one of the most basic things that we can use. We talk about end-tidal being the normal range between 35 and 45 with a squared-looking appearance and waveform. I was bored one day at station. I got in my bunker gear. I put on my SCBA, and I got on the treadmill. And before I did that, I hooked myself up to pulse oximetry, to end-tidal, and I hooked myself up to just a four-lead EKG as well. Did my own little stress test there. So I started working out. And as I started working out, I started, you know, increasing my heart rate, started increasing my metabolism. We talked earlier about ventilation, perfusion, and metabolism, and that capnography is tied to metabolism. As metabolism increases, so does CO2 production. Metabolism decreases, so does CO2 production. They're linearly linked. So if I get on the treadmill and I start to work out, I'm increasing my metabolism. So it would stand to reason then that I would also see an increase in my end-tidal, because I'm increasing CO2 production. But I didn't. My end-tidal stayed between 35 to 45. That was on that high end of 45. But it did stay between normal range. Why is that? It stayed that way because I increased my respiratory rate to compensate for the CO2 production. Now, why is that important? It's important because when I use capnography to measure ventilatory status and I have someone who's breathing at a rate of 30 and I put them on end tidal and they have a normal range and a normal appearing waveform, they're compensating for something. That increased respiratory rate of 30 they're doing it for a reason. It's not hyperventilation. They're doing it to combat some type of, typically going to be a metabolic issue. Septic patients. Your septic patients typically have an increased metabolism because they're trying to fight off that infection. As long as their perfusion status is normal, you'll see a normal end tidal, even though the respiratory rate may be 24, 26, even as high as 30. One of the things that we look at when measuring ventilatory status is in the case of excited delirium. It's a big catchphrase that's out there right now. Here you've got a young male who has been resisting arrest, running from the cops, et cetera. He's been tased, maybe shot with a beanbag gun or something like that, but he's restrained. He's in police custody now. Of course, he's going to have an increased respiratory rate. He's just been massive catecholamine dump as he's been going through this fight or flight response, trying to get away from the police. When we put capnography on, if he has a normal end tidal, that respiratory rate's compensating. We're not so worried about the excited delirium case at this point. However, if you put that end tidal on and it's either high or low, we've got a problem. We've actually had cases here. We have a specific protocol for the actual protocol is called the violent or agitated patient in police custody. But we had some excited delirium cases, so this protocol came into effect. And one of the things that we have to monitor on these patients is end tidal capnography. It's mandatory. It's not something that, put it on if you want. No, you will monitor end tidal capnography. We've had two cases that have been caught from paramedics when they put them on end tidal that their end tidals were outside that normal range, and the medics said, I guess I better take them. Both those cases went into cardiac arrest, one on the way to the hospital and the second one at the hospital. Now, excited delirium is a difficult management case. Now, the only thing we can really do is try to slow them down with some type of sedative to try to break that cycle. But both those medics came back and said, I wasn't really thinking this guy was sick, and I'm glad I used this tool because it at least told me something was going wrong. I didn't realize he was going to arrest, but I knew something was going on.
And I like the focus that you have there on this is not a standalone tool. This is part of your assessment and needs to be included when you start trying to generate a picture of what's going on with this patient. So often we get focused and get that tunnel vision on, I need to look at this one number. I need to look at the trending on this one thing. It's not just about blood pressure, pulse, respirations, each of those things individually. It's also about what's going on in the patient as a whole picture. If you're working a standby at a marathon, and you have a guy who's just run, it's just been running for 10 miles, you're going to have a different picture going on for that patient. And as you said, he may have a normal reading on his end tidal CO2, but his respiratory rate's increased because he's compensating for something going on that has been happening. And we need to look at that whole picture rather than just in this one device reading, because you're going to get caught and you can still pick up on this is normal as far as a range, but there's something abnormal going on because of the rest of the picture doesn't match up with the normal number here.
Exactly. That really is, it is putting those pieces of the puzzle together. I mean, that's kind of what we do. That's what your whole assessment is about. It's about getting an idea of what could be going wrong with someone and then putting those pieces together of the puzzle to figure out, is it what you originally thought or is it something different? Do those signs and symptoms match up for that condition with what you're finding? Yes or no? Well, maybe I need to try something different. So that's the type of issue that we look at with capnography. Is it's just, again, it's one more piece of the puzzle. But when you are dealing with that puzzle, it is the piece that will tell you changes sooner than anything else that we have. And, when we start talking about let's go back to that person I'm giving pain medication to. Mm-hmm. If they become hypoxic over time, again, we already talked about how pulse oximetry, the limitation of that, it's slower. But we're also going to see heart rate increase and other type agitation, things like that. But we may not notice them as quickly as that waveform change, that numeric change, or if they truly quit breathing, that loss of the last waveform. So that they quit breathing, we lose that waveform, and that's the big key. I'll tell you a case. Like I said, I get called in to do trainings the same as everyone else out there does, and one of the questions I always ask myself is, you know, hey, what's in it for me? How is this class, how is this training, how is this device going to help me at 2 o'clock in the morning take care of my patient? And I hear that a lot when I talk about capnography. Is, yeah, great, I'm not going to change the way I treat the patient because of capnography. I'm just going to be able to know something's going on. But how does that really help me? So in my system, we actually run an engine and a medic unit out of the same station with the same three guys. Depending on the call, we get in one or the other, and the other just sits back. So I've got two EMTs and myself. We go out on a call for it comes out as a motor vehicle collision with an unresponsive male. Get there on scene. Turns out it's just a guy who had been drinking, slow runoff in the parking lot of his apartment complex into the grass area there. No damage to the car. This isn't a trauma scene at all. This is just purely the issue with him and his intoxication. He relates to us that he's got stage 4 brain cancer. He was just diagnosed a couple days before, and he went out and tied one on. And, you know, I was like, you're entitled. Don't get behind the car, but you can feel free to tie one on with that type of diagnosis. It looked, at all appearances, a BLS call. I got in the front seat. I was driving to the hospital. My BLS partners were in the back. Now, my guys, we use capnography on a lot of different patients. They used it on this one. Altered mental statuses. I kind of talked about the cases that I use them on. Altered mental states is another one that every one of my altered mental states gets capnography put on. My BLS guys know that. This isn't an ALS skill, capnography, so they've got it on. As we're driving to the hospital, I hear the alarm go off. That's that 30-second apnea alarm. And I say to the guys, hey, alarm going off there. What alarm is that? And they said, oh, it's a pulse oximeter. And I said, no, that's not the pulse oximeter alarm. That's your capnography alarm. Is he breathing? They looked at his chest wall movement, which was moving in and out, and they said, yes, he's breathing. I said, is the filter line set in place? It's still on his face? Yep. Is there a waveform on the monitor? To which they answered, no. I pulled over. Get in the back. Yes, this guy does have chest wall movement. I put my hand down next to his mouth and nose, but there is no actual ventilation that's occurring. There's no air moving in or out. And we got a problem. Big sternal rub, the guy kind of wakes up, takes a big old deep breath, and bam, now I got an end tidal of 55. You know, he'd been retaining some CO2 there when he wasn't breathing. After a few breaths, he's back down between 35 to 45. I'm like, wow, this is kind of interesting. I stay in the back of the rig. He had these periods where he would breathe normally or maybe even a little tachypneic, and then he would become apneic. And I'd have to sternal rub him again, try to get him to respond. You know, I just didn't feel comfortable about him. I was thinking about intubating him, but, you know, he hadn't met that threshold yet for me. But what he did meet the threshold for was, I've got something that's not right here, and I need to talk to a doc when I get to the hospital. So instead of turning that patient over to the nurse, I said, I need a doc in the room. The doc comes in. I said, hey, look, I know he's acting fine right now. Will you stay in this room for just 5 minutes with me and watch what happens with his ventilatory pattern? He did it again. And the doc says, wow, that's not right. I mean, it was a busy night. He says, I don't have time. He ended up paralyzing him and intubating him. Well, on follow-up, what was happening was he had increased intracranial pressure from his tumor in his brain, and he was chain-stoke ventilating. That's what we were seeing. Those periods of apnea that was told to us by the monitor, he still had chest wall movement, but no actual air exchange was occurring. So to the normal eye, the guy sat in the back, and I would have done the same thing without capnography. Here's a guy whose pulse oximetry is 99%, who looks like he's breathing, but in reality, he wasn't breathing effectively. That's how capnography can help you, the end provider, at 2 o'clock in the morning, when you're looking at this patient thinking, you know what, I think everything's okay. And then a little bit later, well, maybe something's not okay. And I've got stories like that since 1998 that capnography has told me something was going on that I didn't catch through the normal methods that I would do an assessment with.
And it really is about providing you the tools, just another tool to back you up. And you know, yeah, we talk about how important documentation is. You know, documentation only works if you have something you actually know that you can write. You know, sitting there and saying, well, you know, he looked like he was breathing is not going to hold up in court when you put it in your documentation.
Yeah, very true, very true. Yeah, I can, that's the nice thing about capnography, that I can show that number, and without a doubt, we know what was, you know, that the person was ventilating or not ventilating at the time, or how well they were ventilating at the time. And so, yeah, and that's where really kind of capnography took its stronghold, was because of that in the intubated patient, it wasn't questionable. We knew it was in the right spot. Right. We knew when we lost it. We knew whatever it was. And that's really where it took its stronghold. And then we started realizing, wait a minute, there's so much more we can do with this.
And I had a tube dislodged when they moved a patient from our stretcher to the bed in the ER. And I was instantly told by the respiratory therapist that was there, your tube's not in. And, you know, the ER doc looked at me and I went, that tube was in when we were on the, when we were in the ambulance pulling into the bay. And I was able to print out and say, because I always run a strip when I get to the hospital before I move the patient out of the ambulance. And I had, you know, I had waveform capnography that respiratory therapist, now luckily respiratory therapist, guess what? They know what they're looking at. So does the ER doc. And they instantly said, okay, good. That we must have moved it when we bumped him over. You don't have that protection unless you have a tool like your capnography device attached, reading that waveform, and you get in the habit of running a strip before you move that patient into the hospital.
Yeah, there's a guy that does some teaching that I do teaching with, and Robbie Murray, back out of Delaware, and they had a case, pretty high profile case, in which the tube had become dislodged, and there was a long period of time that wasn't identified after it was. That's just after turnover at the ED. There was a long period of time that it wasn't identified. The patient ended up going into bradycardic arrest, and you know, it was a bad, bad deal all the way around. And when they got called in to review that case with the attorneys, one of the attorneys that was there started talking about capnography and how, you know, this wouldn't have happened if you've been using capnography, and I can't believe you guys don't have capnography. Not just talking to the pre-hospital providers, but also to the ED staff, and, you know, why weren't you using capnography, and really kind of hammering down this capnography issue. And Robbie says, excuse me, here's our strip that we printed as we came into the ED with waveform capnography. And the attorneys literally said, you guys are excused. And you know, from a perspective, patient safety perspective, that's invaluable. From, if you want to look at it from just the legal perspective of protecting yourself, or from an entity protecting themselves from lawsuit, again, it's invaluable. And that's really why we've seen such a big push with capnography in the intubated patients, because it is something that you really can't argue with. If it's there, it's there. You know it's there.
Well, you know, Troy, you and I could probably sit here and talk about this all day long, and I think on occasions we have.
Yeah.
And I know we're gonna have seen you here at EMS World, and hopefully get you on the show in one of our live episodes there, and we can talk about this some more. I'd really like to delve into some of the things we see when we use this most commonly in a cardiac arrest situation, return of circulation, because that is really, when I first started using capnography, it really was one of the most amazing things I'd ever seen. That first patient, I knew I had return of circulation the first time because I saw the numbers on the capnography well before I ever got a pulse, well before I ever saw that this patient might have been breathing. I saw it because we were still ventilating them at that point, but you know, they weren't breathing on their own. They didn't have a discernible pulse, but that heart had started beating because we were seeing the numbers on perfusion increase. I've also been really excited about using it as a tool to judge how effective our compressions are. And there's so many things that we can do with this. So we're going to continue this discussion at EMS World in Vegas and then beyond, hopefully, because this is just something I think we need to be just, you know, doing a capnography corner once a month or something here on the show. And you know, I'm willing, if you're willing, we can pull something together, you know, a 1 minute tip or something. But this is something we need to start hammering in. And like you said, it is not an ALS skill. It's a BLS skill. You can read that waveform. If you can read pulse ox, you can read a capnography.
Absolutely. I am, like you said, I'm very passionate about people understanding what capnography can do for them, how it can make their job easier, and really kind of at the end, make how we take care of patients much better. So I'm up for whatever you're willing to give me airtime for, and let's get this message out.
Hey, if somebody wants to get in touch with you, maybe they'd like to bring you in to talk to them about training or working in their system to help them get people up to speed on some of the other ways to use capnography besides the most expensive tube checker in the world. where can they get a hold of you?
They can reach me at tsmith7@comcast.net.
Okay. And I'll have that link in the show notes.
Homer's County Fire District 7.
Okay.
Yeah,
I'll have that link in the show notes so you can find that. But it is, and if you're watching the video version of this, I'll actually have that on the screen. I'll put that up there as a graphic. Troy, thank you so much for getting in touch with me and making sure I stayed on the track. And so many things that come in that I want to do, and I appreciate you staying with me to make sure we got this done today. And I'm so looking forward to catching up with you at EMS World in Vegas.
Great. I appreciate you giving me the opportunity, and I'll see you in a week.
Yep, sounds good. And that's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. I want to thank everybody for checking out the show this week and urge you to get over to the website MedicCast.com/blog. Check out the links over there for everything discussed in this episode. You'll find the show notes link right there at the top of the page, and you can follow that and catch every single episode's links from the news items to additional resource links associated with the tip of the week, all available for you over there. You'll find the most recent episode listed first, and you can scroll down and find past episodes just by checking out down there. Again, MedicCast.com/blog. You can also, of course, find video segments of this episode and all the episodes recently in the last year and a half, 2 years, over at MedicCast.tv. That'll take you directly to the section of the MedicCast blog for our video segments. The MedicCast.tv pages take you to our short video segments from conferences and from short videos I produce here at the MedicCast studios, all the way up through full episodes of the MedicCast each and every week. So check that out. You can reach me if you'd like to leave a comment, a suggestion, or a question, and share your thoughts with the rest of the MedicCast community by checking in here at podmedic@mac.com. You can also reach me over on Facebook and Twitter under the handle podmedic, twitter.com/podmedic and facebook.com/podmedic. And don't forget the MedicCast fan page, facebook.com/mediccast. You know, we're pushing towards 3,000 fans of the MedicCast over there. And if you haven't already done so, you can head over there, click the like button at the top of the page. I post other articles and links and videos and things that I find throughout the course of each week directly to that fan page for the members there. So if you're on Facebook and you haven't become a fan of the MedicCast, you should definitely do so. That's it. We're going to go ahead and close out the show here. I hope you will continue to support the MedicCast and everything we've been doing and our recent efforts and everything over at EMS World Expo this week and beyond at other conferences as we get to them. You know, we're continuing to grow and expand the types of things we cover here at the MedicCast. And of course, in association with all of our associated healthcare and EMS shows over at the ProMed Network, promednetwork.com. But it's your support and your community efforts as a member of our audience that really continue to build our show. So continue to share the MedicCast with people you know, and we'll continue to bring out a great show here and also with our associated friends and podcasters over at the ProMed Network. I'm Jamie Davis, the PodMedic. I'll be back soon with another episode here of the MedicCast. In the meantime, you should make sure you're staying safe and keep in mind, scene safety, BSI.